and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hey, everyone.
Today we are going to be doing a movie that came out the year of my birth, 1973, the sci-fi techno thriller Westworld, written and directed by Michael Crichton. This is actually our third Michael Crichton directed movie. We discussed Runaway way back when we started this podcast, and Looker, not too long ago, we discussed Looker.
I want to say it'll probably end up being about a year ago. I think we did it like last winter.
Really?
Or spring, maybe.
Funny, it doesn't seem that long ago. Not that it matters.
Yeah, yeah.
This is his feature, well, his the first movie he directed for theatrical release. Apparently it's his second time as director. The first thing he directed was a ABC movie of the week called Pursuit that I couldn't find much information on. It sounded interesting, like a terrorist or somebody wants to set off a nuclear bomb somewhere. I couldn't find much more information than that, but it was interesting. And I guess he just didn't want to have his first theatrical film that he directed be a science fiction film. I guess he just doesn't want to be either. Maybe he doesn't like directing science fiction. He likes writing it. I don't know.
But I
can kind of understand, you know, it's like, look, I like other things. I can do other things. Let me do something else.
Right. Like, you know, we were talking before we started recording. Like, I wonder, like, I think Jurassic Park is fantastic, right? I wouldn't change Jurassic Park at all, but I'm kind of interested in seeing what he would have done with that, you know, how he might have directed it differently, because I do think it would have been different. Because I think he's an underrated director. I think he's a fantastic director.
Well, he definitely knows how to do, like, not only sci-fi, but the type of sci-fi you don't normally see.
Right.
Like the more harder edged, not harder edged, but like the more realistic sci-fi, like, you know,
exactly,
trying to do something we can possibly see in our lifetime.
Right.
Even if it is a little far out, it's not something as far out as, you know, faster than light travel or, you know, these strange alien worlds. It's really like with Looker, Westworld, and Runaway, it's about technology we create and how it can be used against us.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It's all stuff that, like, it takes the possibility of what we have now and what is being worked on and just, you know, takes it a step further, or, you know, makes it more ubiquitous and then in its own way inherently dangerous in ways that we just didn't quite expect. Although people should have seen this coming.
Well, you know,
in this movie, like, they totally should have seen this coming.
It's easy enough to see it as cliche today, but I don't know how cliche it was in 1973.
No, I don't mean in terms of cliche at all. No, I like this movie an awful lot, and we'll get into that. I'm talking about the Delos Corporation.
Well,
they
Delos
should have totally seen this coming, like a mile away.
Yeah, Delos really didn't seem to think too much in advance of, you know, visitor safety or employee safety.
Right, right. That's what I'm getting at. Like, Delos, man, like, they did a great job. Like, the whole atmosphere and everything works, but how could you not have seen basically this happening at some point?
Yeah. But before we, well, this is part of discussing the movie, because I realized something while we were rewatching it the other night. And that I had been wrong in my assumption and helped spread misinformation within our own podcast.
Oh.
A while back, we covered The Towering Inferno.
Right.
And I had always heard, I've heard movie hosts say it. You do a quick Google search on the internet about what's the first movie to use that staggered billing. Because in Towering Inferno, You get Steve McQueen and Paul Newman. They both come up on the screen at the same time, but Steve McQueen is down and to the left, and Paul Newman is up and to the right. So if you're reading left to right, you see Steve McQueen first, but if you read top to bottom, you see Paul Newman first. And I've always been told, oh, that was used and done for the first time for Towering Inferno, which came out in 1974. Westworld came out in 1973, and Yul Brynner and Richard Benjamin are credited on screen at the same time, with Yul Brynner down and to the left and Richard Benjamin slightly up and to the right. This movie did it before Towering Inferno.
Okay. I didn't. Okay.
And again, when I before, you know, we came on, I was just double every time I put in to any type of search to look in what movie used the staggered billing first, Towering Inferno was the one that kept coming up.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at it now. You're right. It is.
And,
yeah.
Well, yeah. And then I double checked Westworld, 1973, you know, over a year. And then I was like, okay, well, maybe. Obviously, you know, I think Towering Inferno would have had a long production. So I kind of looked into that, the production of Towering Inferno. It's like maybe they did it and kind of announced it before Westworld. But Westworld was in theaters before Irwin Allen started making announcements about the production of the Towering Inferno.
I mean, is it because... Are we splitting hairs, I guess, because it's the difference between the first or second title card shown? Because James Brolin's the first credit, technically.
No. It's Yul Brynner.
Oh, I thought James Brolin was the first credit.
No. I remember seeing it as James, Yul Brynner and Richard Benjamin come up on the same time. And I have this already up on Twitter. So if you follow, or X, if you follow me on Twitter/X, or Blue Sky, oh. I've got these up side by side, but I believe it goes Yul Brynner, Richard Benjamin in Westworld, and then Josh Brolin's name.
Yes, you're right. Yep, you're right.
Yeah, so
you're
he's
absolutely right. That's right after, yeah, sure, right, yeah, after the Delos intro. You see the Metro Golden Mayer presents Yul Brynner, Richard Benjamin in Westworld, James Brolin. Yep, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And, you know, again, I was re-listening to our podcast on Towering Inferno, and sure enough, I said it there.
Now,
so I was wrong.
Is it possible, one, Mandela effect? You know, maybe.
Well, I think it's just because, one, it's so, one of the biggest behind-the-scenes stories of Towering Inferno is about the ego of Paul Newman and, sure, Steve McQueen, and them both insisting on, you know, having matching amount of lines. And so I think that's, you know, what people go back to. And again, who's really looking for this, especially before today's age of the internet, where you can easily look up these facts?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure back when you had to actually go through and watch all these movies, somebody just decided, it's Towering Inferno. Yeah, but you only watched 1,500 movies. There's another 1,500. It's Towering Inferno. Towering Inferno did it first. Leave me alone.
So you're saying probably not an alternate universe?
I think it's unlikely.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Since you uncovered like a major secret, are we in danger of our lives at the moment?
Well, no, but, you know, the thing is, you know, it's not like we're noted film historians. At best, we're rogue film historians.
Yes, well, there you go. Well, that sounds better anyway.
Yeah, ne'er-do-well, rapscallion, rogue film historians.
I'm just saying there might have been people who made an awful lot of money on the, I guess, fake news story.
Well, I think,
and they could be hiring assassins.
There has to be an asterisk there somewhere.
Fair enough.
All right. So moving on, the movie opens with a kind of a fake commercial for the Delos theme park, where, love, you know, it, they talk about, you know, people who have just visited the park, and they're talking about all their adventures and experiences of having visited Westworld, Roman world, and medieval world, authentically recreated, where you can, you know, to choose the world you want to experience and get in either gunfights or sword fights or visit a vomitorium.
Apparently, yes. Like,
you know,
I mean, everything is super authentic.
And it's all for a mere $1,000 a day.
Yes, which I checked, and in today's money, is, I think I want to say something like $7,000 a day or something. Basically, I think it works out to like $50,000-ish a week or so, which if you have that kind of money, it seems pretty cool.
If I could afford to go to a place like Westworld, I would do it in a second. Right. That is so my type of thing.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I don't know if I'd go to Medieval World or Westworld, but yeah, it's pretty neat.
There's a few things that, though, I would
and they build it up so well.
Personally, I would tweak about, because when you know they get there, you know, we follow James Brolin, and Richard Benjamin as two buddies visiting Westworld. James Brolin has been there before, and this is Richard Benjamin's first time, and. You know, Richard Benjamin's kind of more all excited about, he's asking all these questions, and James Brolin's like, well, you can do however you want, you know, you can get a type of gun with a string for fast draw, you can, you know, do all the stuff we used to do, or when we used to play cowboys and outlaws and, you know, as kids.
Right.
Only now we can do it more for real. And the androids that are you know, part of the experience are so human, real, and lifelike. They're almost indistinguishable from humans, except for their hands, which haven't been quite perfected yet.
Which is great. I mean, that's exactly what you want. Until you come to find out, they give you guns with live ammunition.
And they make this whole thing like, well. James Brolin's like, go ahead, point the gun at me and pull the trigger. And he's like, okay. And he doesn't. It's like, yeah, there's a little sensor in the gun that it won't, you know, if it detects any body heat, it won't fire. I'm like, that sounds like that could malfunction and end up with the problem.
Right. And you end up with like a little round piece of book in the back of your head, you know, because he's just sitting there nonchalantly like, well, a guy points a loaded gun at him. Assuming this thing isn't going to fail and blast him in the face, which is, it's kind of important.
If they can design these guns with the light sensor in it, they can design them to like almost do like a light gun and then trigger a squib that is on the robot instead of firing a live round that damages the robot and they will have to fix.
Right. It seemed like a needlessly complex thing to do when there's like there's tons of safer ways.
However, they need to do it for the movie to work.
For sure.
But again, you know what? Even if you're going to arm the guests with live ammunition, why would you arm the robots with live ammunition? Even though they're programmed to lose the fight.
Right.
It would seem even less, you know, reasonable. But again, we don't know whether the robot was armed with live ammunition or whether he stole the live ammunition. We don't really. There's a lot about the Lobot Rebellion we don't know about.
Exactly, yes.
But
is it even a robot rebellion?
Getting into other things, when Richard Benjamin and, you know, James Brolin and Dick Van Patten, who are all visiting Westworld, you know, after you see them get into their authentic Western outfits and they get to their room, Richard Benjamin's like, well, this mattress is kind of uncomfortable. And Josh Brolin's like, well, yes, but it's authentic. This is where I want to draw for me.
Right.
I think the rooms, especially if you're paying $1,000 a day,
yeah,
the rooms don't need to be authentic. I still want indoor plumbing. I still want air conditioning. Let me go into a room with a nice comfortable bed and a nice comfortable mattress. And you know what? Maybe I have to pay a little bit more for that option. But that should be an option. Because yes, there are people who do like to visit dude ranches and want that authentic, you know, authentic feel. But you know what? If I'm going there, it's like, no. Give me a nice room to be in for when I'm not experiencing the park and I'm out in the West. Let me come to a comfortable air conditioning, indoor plumbing, and all that.
Right. Effectively, actually, $7,000 a day in today's money. But you'd also think it would have been more...
Because also, if you want to make it authentic, well, am I going to be exposed to cholera?
Right. And
tuberculosis, right, all the other things that went rampant through the West.
Heaven forbid. I mean, you're dealing with presumably, well, live Probably horses, or at the very least, real gravity. Like there's a real chance you get actually hurt. So what? You go to old timey doctor? You know,
Yeah, you get an
sorry, we're
absolute.
cutting your leg off.
Yeah, you got a splinter. We're gonna have to take you off that arm.
Like how extreme are they willing to go here? Because for some of it, it's just like okay, I appreciate, I guess, that you want to make this super. I wonder if it's a checkbox, right? I wonder if it's a checkbox because it seems like in some cases more work to make the rudimentary super authentic bed than it would be just to buy like hotel bed
Yeah,
X, you know,
and yeah, it gives you a
from the
nice little
hotel bed
hotel room.
factory. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, you get even like they talk about all through the thing how you know it's high tech, no expenses were spared, and you do see you know there's constantly they're constantly being monitored.
Yeah.
There's technicians at the ready everywhere monitoring everything's going on for the visitor safety.
In an
You know,
airtight bunker for some reason.
yeah. As we also already pointed out, you know, the guns are designed so that they shouldn't fire on another guest, and the robots can't. There's a scene where Brolin and Benjamin are at a saloon and a fist fight breaks out.
Yes.
How do you guarantee people safety? Because again, even if the robots are programmed not to punch you in the face, I would think punching a robot in the face is still going to hurt your hand. And two, if you're in a big fight and brawling and punching and throwing whoever's next to you, how do you ensure I'm not punching another visitor dead in the face and throwing him off the balcony and throwing him through the glass, you know, plate glass of the saloon?
Absolutely, yeah. Like in my head, you know, I stitch it together as all right, maybe the robots are covered in some sort of like gelatin, so it's more or less like punching beef, right? I presumably the robots are pulling their punches back, and in most cases you can see that they're not trying to fight back anyway, at least unless it's amongst themselves. I think more importantly though, and we had discussed it when we were watching it, you know, based on the 50 grand. It looks like they only let in a handful of people in any given
Exactly.
world, which I think is key because you don't want this looking like with thousands, like a throng of people out there on the street all day, left and right. You know, that's not the experience you're looking for. So it looks like the person to robot ratio is like 1 to 50 or more. I mean, like, I think almost everybody's a robot except for like the 5 or 6 people we follow.
There seems to be about a dozen visitors at any time because
Yeah.
it seems like about a dozen people get on because it's a small hovercraft that takes them over the desert to where the park is, and then you see them get on their trams to the park, and it doesn't look like you could those trams could carry more than a dozen people at a time.
Right.
And other than for instance, in Westworld, we know James Brolin, Richard Benjamin, and Dick Van Patten are all visiting Westworld. With, I would say, at least two or three other people we don't really get to know.
Right, you see them come out of the carriage. We're assuming they're
But,
visitors, but you never see them again.
and you know, maybe they make it a point to say, this is, you know, Richard Benjamin and this is Dick Van Patten. Keep look at each other and know who you all are so
Right.
that when you're smashing a whiskey bottle over a person's head, you know it's not the guy you met on the stagecoach coming in because. We don't have insurance coverage for that. Because you smash a whiskey bottle over somebody's head, you're killing them.
I think the way you fix this is that, you know, when you get the people coming in, you set up a world where you all agree to either be the law or like, you know, the bad guys. So that way at
Well, no,
least you know whose
because
side
that's.
you're
But that's the whole thing is that if you want to be sheriff in Westworld, you can be sheriff. If you
Yeah.
want to participate in a bank robbery, you could participate in a bank robbery. I
It's
would
really
probably
neat.
just say, all right, all the visitors have to wear this blue neckerchief. And if you see a blue neckerchief, you know they're a visitor.
Right. It's really neat. And the Simpsons, was it in a Treehouse of Horror or was it a normal Simpsons where they
Nope, it
parody
was
this?
they when they visit Itchy and Scratchy Land.
Yeah. They parody this, you know, quite heavily.
Yes. And it's a great parody.
It really is.
You know, and again, this movie, you can see, of course, you can see the seeds planted for Jurassic Park that will come, you know, as a novel at least. Well, the movie was like 20 years. Yeah, I think the movie's 93. So 20
93,
years after.
94 sounds right, yeah.
right after, you know, 20 years after Westworld. I mean, he probably wrote the novel earlier in the 90s, but
did well, what about Future World? Was that him, or was that tacked on? Or
Future World is the sequel to this.
Was it a book he wrote?
I don't believe so. I think it was. I should have looked it up better, but
it's like Pet Cemetery 2, basically.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Because there was also the extremely short-lived Beyond Westworld TV series, and then there was the Westworld TV series on HBO. Yes. That I've never seen, and from what I understand was excellent in first, but then just kind of fell apart and then was canceled without any satisfying conclusion. So I'm not even going to be bothered. Oh, well. But that's only what I've heard. I don't know. I've never seen
it. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, if it's canceled without a conclusion, then I'm certainly not, probably not going to bother.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, this is supposed to be a fun little adventure movie, and, you know, we're doing all, throwing all these nitpicks at it that, you know, you're just supposed to sit back and eat some popcorn and not really think about too much.
Well, no, because this movie is really fun. I when was the last time you had seen this before Friday?
Maybe 10 years back.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I see, for some reason, I thought you watched this more often than I had. Like, I don't think I'd seen this movie for a good 30 years or more. And it's one of those ones where it more or less made an impression on me of like, yeah, no, I did like it. But I, you know, again, I recalled less and less of it over time because I never watched it again. And I regret that because I liked this an awful lot. And in hindsight, it's like, you know, I like all these other Michael Crichton films. I'm not really sure why I don't watch this one more often. But this and Looker are going to have to get more views. This in particular. This is a lot of fun.
This one, for whatever reason, I remember having it on VHS. I never got it on. I just never got around to getting it on DVD, and it wasn't until recently that I bought the Blu-ray. But it was something that I would pop up. I would notice it would be a lot free on demand, you know, on cable and most, you know, a lot of channels. So
it's a lot of fun. So I'm just gonna. I'm sure you do, but I absolutely recommend seeing this movie. It's fantastic.
It also shows. It also shows that if I believe Michael Crichton could have directed a Western.
Yes.
If he had wanted to.
Yeah. I think he's an underrated. He was an underrated director. I think this is another film. I really wouldn't change anything, even for the stuff that we did picked about it. Like, I don't know. I really enjoyed every moment of this one.
I'm going to announce my Whip Pistol Award winner, Dick Van Patten.
Of course, yeah.
Because he's playing kind of a nerdy guy showing up at the Westworld, and, you know, he's having fun. He gets in the brawl. There's a point where the fake, you know, the robot sheriff is killed during a jailbreak, and he decides he wants to be the sheriff. And he gets this great little scene where he puts on the badge, yes, and comes out of the sheriff's office and announces there's a new sheriff. And he even changes his voice to sound tougher. You know, he's really putting himself into it. So that's, in a way, double acting. And as he tries to, you know, stoically go back inside to the, you know, he get the sheriff's door open. But, you know, he still keeps playing it off. And, you know, I'm kind of glad we don't see what happens to him. I assume he gets killed because it seems like almost everybody but, you know, Richard Benjamin ends up dying in this movie. But I'm kind of glad we don't see this poor guy getting killed.
No.
I'd rather imagine somehow he did escape, just like maybe they got him to safety.
Well, that's the thing. We don't really necessarily know that the robots killed everyone. No. We just know that the humans were vastly outnumbered, and it's probably likely. And also, I have to call us out. This is our fifth. This would be our fifth Michael Crichton.
Really?
Yes.
What were the other two?
Fourth then, I guess. We skipped a Michael Crichton movie that we did. we always forget, and I'm pretty sure we said as much in the podcast, that 13th Warrior is a Michael Crichton movie.
Oh, right, but he didn't direct it.
No, he didn't direct it, no.
No, that's, all right, so I was just thinking of the movies he directed.
Oh, fair enough, okay.
Yeah. Although
it just occurred to me that he also, the 13th Warrior was also him.
Yeah, and I wasn't thinking of that either, but yeah. So, Richard Benjamin and Josh Brolin are, of course, enjoying the whole thing, and we get to see how the days are pretty much staged, and the robots are pretty much programmed to give the visitors an experience
right.
that doesn't seem like they don't have to come up with everything, because they're both at the bar and, you know, they're they're drinking their whiskey.
It seems almost itinerized in that it's like, okay, this is the day that we go to the bar fight, and, you know, there's also going to be like random shootouts in the back somewhere, like the bank might get robbed, that sort of thing.
So he's at the bar, you know, Richard Benjamin and James Brolin, they're just, you know, sipping their whiskey, and in comes Yul Brynner, who is absolutely fantastic in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
He's, you know, all in his Magnificent Seven garb, marching in, playing, you know, the villain, all in black, and he purposely bumps into Richard Benjamin and makes him spill his drink, and then he goes up to the bar and orders his own drink. And Richard Benjamin's all like, oh, man, that guy made me spill my drink. And, you know, James Brolin.
I think you said when we were watching this that at no other point has he looked more like Josh Brolin, or has Josh Brolin looked more like him.
Yes. So he's egging on his buddy Richard, being like, shoot him, shoot him. He's challenging you. And then when he doesn't say anything, Yul Brynner goes, you're sloppy with your drink. And, you know, adding insult to injury. And it's like, this is great. You know, the gunfighter is there egging him on.
Right.
Challenging him to a duel.
Right.
So that he can fully be kind of in the old West justified in pulling his gun and shooting him. Because he even says, finally, he answers the Yul Brynner robot. Is like, you talk too much. What did you say? I said you talk too much. And he gets the gun down, Yul Brynner, in a duel where they both go for their guns at the same time. And again, we know the robot is programmed to lose.
Right.
But it would still feel authentic. Right. It would still feel like, I outdrew this outlaw bully and sent him flying. And it's pretty, like, they have these robots set up to spurt vast amounts of blood as they're gunned down.
Oh, it's fantastic.
And die dramatically. So it's unclear exactly when the revolt happens, because, you know, it keeps cutting back to the technicians, you know, monitoring things and saying like, oh, that's weird. That robot is, you know, that female robot, which is programmed to be, for lack of a better word, a pleasure bot.
Right.
Is spurring the guests' advances. They're not supposed to do that. Well, we'll look into it. And they discuss how they're noticing little tiny malfunctions. And one of them's like, well, maybe we should shut down the park for a little bit and look into all this. And the other one says, like, I agree, but I don't think we need to send our current visitors home. I think we can shut down for a little while and look into this, but we can wait until the visitors who are here now, their time is up.
At least put away the real swords and live ammunition.
So, you know, we see the Yul Brynner robot getting repaired, and they're talking about how, like, oh, we're going to do, while we have him repaired, we're going to upgrade his visuals and his hearing and all these other stuff. We're going to do all these upgrades on it.
Hopefully he won't turn into a murder machine, because if he does, oh boy, he'll be really good at it.
Yes, so the next morning in the park, you know, while Richard Benjamin is, you know, taking a bath in the bathing area, the Yul Brynner robot comes to their room and is holding James Brolin.
There you go. You got it.
Hostage with a gun. And you're kind of like, all right, what's the scenario here? Obviously, you know, the robot can't be pretending it's here for revenge because the character it was playing is killed.
It's dead, yeah.
Is this the beginning of the revolt? Is this the robot's first, like, I'm tired of losing to these guests and I want revenge on the guy who gunned me down?
Right. Or is this just, like, ultimately this is what a grand gets you? Like, they, you know, they're still working on it, but he is, like, the villain bot.
Right.
We got the one. And,
you know, he's the twin. We can even use in my own head, he's the twin brother of the guy I gunned down, and he's looking for revenge.
Because he's wearing the same outfit, everything, yeah.
But, yeah, no, if you think about it, you know, he's holding the gun on James Brolin, But that's a useless gesture, apparent for the. It should be a useless gesture for these robots.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether James Brolin has a gun on him or not. He should be able to go to wherever the gun is in the room, grab it, and shoot the robot before the robot can do anything. So, was this an early stage revolt of the robots, or again, was this all planned out for more excitement for you know, Richard Benjamin to gun him down again? Well, things seem to happen pretty quickly after that, because Richard Benjamin, you know, storms into the room, blows away Yul Brynner again, shoots him right out the window. It's a spectacular scene. And then he's arrested by the sheriff for shooting a guy. And again, this is another thing obviously programmed to set up. Like, now you can participate in a jailbreak.
Which makes you think the whole thing was probably staged.
Possibly, you know, or, you know.
Just to get him in jail, right?
Like we said, they were watching them being constantly monitored. So it might even be the technicians programming this stuff as it goes, so that the story seems to develop naturally.
Oh, maybe.
So,
or yeah, I mean, to your point, maybe that was something that maybe that was cover to make it seem like, oh yeah, that's totally what we intended to happen. So now we can throw you in jail.
Yes. Yeah. So they do a jailbreak, and you know, James Brolin and Richard Benjamin ride to the outskirts of town, you know, waiting for their wanted level to go down, apparently. And that's when James Brolin is attacked by a robot snake, because even the snakes are robots in Westworld, right, which is a good idea. You don't want to have real rattlers out there attacking the patients, but the rattler attacks and bites James Brolin. And even James Brolin is like, that's not supposed to happen. It's not, you know, and the one of the lead technicians is like, yeah, this is inexcusable. Yeah. It's two minor puncture wounds, but still, this is a problem. They should not be attacking the guests. Well, over in medieval world, where one of the guests is supposed to be in a duel with the Black Knight for his final day of visiting medieval world, so he can have the spectacular sword fight and defeat the Black Knight, the technicians are noticing that the Black Knight is being way too aggressive. Maybe we should pull back on that. And so right. Just like, it's not responding. All right, shut it down. Shut it down now.
Because go ahead. I'm sorry. It's one thing to be in a gunfight with a gun with a robot on the other side that, you know, for one, is programmed to not hurt you, and two, you're not even sure if he has a gun that's loaded anyway, because that would be a terrible idea. When you're in medieval world, like, that's real metal bashing down on your shield arm that, you know, this guy, I don't know what he did for a living, but I doubt he's an athlete.
Well,
like, that's a lot to take. So, yeah.
Again, a fake sword fight is
generally take a lot out of you.
Even a fake sword fight is generally being done by two people who have practiced
right.
And choreographed this. Because even if the robot is functioning properly, if I'm an idiot and spaz out, I might get hit by this thing that was trying to miss me. But because I freaked out because I saw a giant.
Well, because you're not like a fencer. Yeah.
Yeah. I might get hurt just because of my own foolishness.
Right. Like
I flinched. If I hadn't flinched, it wouldn't have hit me.
We didn't go on the rat quest. We didn't get enough XP. You know, we don't know how to do these moves yet.
Yeah.
That's a lot to ask. It's a little bit different when you're sure they're shooting at you with an unloaded gun, you know?
So this guy gets run through by the Black Knight, and now we realize, oh no, it's on. Richard Benjamin and James Brolin come back to Westworld the next morning after, you know, hiding out on the range. No, this was after the barroom brawl. They're heading back to their room. They're drunk and tired, and there's Yul Brynner standing there with steely-eyed menace. And this, the way he's able to hold this grin is just terrifying. I mean, there are elements. This movie is Terminator before Terminator, Jurassic Park before Jurassic Park, Michael Myers before Halloween,
yes,
and Predator before Predator. There's all these elements you will
Aliens
see.
Before Aliens or directed yeah. that, yeah.
in this movie, you will see elements that you will see get used, whether intentionally or not.
Right.
You would have seen them in this movie first.
What I, you know, one of the detractions of this movie, and honestly, it might have been mine after the first time I saw it, was, you know, how much time it takes to more or less get going. Because for the most part, you're basically just seeing people like enjoy themselves at the park. But what I like about how it sets up is that it's very, you know, subtly, for the most part, showing you just how dangerous what they're actually doing is, and they don't realize it.
Yes.
Because one, like, you've seen the poster and have some idea where this is going. But even still, again, like, just the abandon with which they do all these things without just thinking of like any of the repercussions or you know, any of the dangers they're actually in. I kind of like it. I like the way it builds.
They're completely safe and nothing can possibly go wrong.
Right, right.
So the Yul Brynner bot, you know, forces them into the gunfight, and James Brolin's like, you know what? It's my turn to shoot this guy down. Let me do it. And they get to the duel, and James Brolin is drawing his gun, and bang, he falls to the ground, and he gets up, and he's like, I've been shot. And he's kind of laughing, like, I got shot. And Richard Benjamin's like, what? I've been shot.
Probably half wondering if this wasn't staged.
Yeah.
Somehow, you know.
You know, are you joking with me? Are you trying to scare me, pretending you've been shot? Is this part of the...
Because he's not, yeah. Because Brolin's done this before, possibly several times. So, you know, for all he knows, he had worked something out.
And then Yul Brynner fires again, killing James Brolin on the spot. And this is also another little twist, because as we've been watching the movie, James Brolin has been playing the rough and tumble guy, the guy who's going to be the hero, you know, and is going to, you know, rise to the challenge. Whereas Richard Benjamin's playing the bit, you know, of a meeker, you know, non-heroic type.
That really got me. Like that one surprised me. I was not expecting him to die then and there like that at all. That completely took me off guard, because the movie had been like, it had been focusing mostly on the both of them, but it, you know, you could argue slightly more so in some way on James Brolin, or I guess, like you said, maybe it just feels that way because he's so used to the place and he's explaining everything to Richard Benjamin. But the way it just happens just like that, I was absolutely not expecting.
Well, that, and there, even if you look at the way that the two characters are made up,
right,
and just the basic look. You know, James Brolin looks like a Western cowboy, action, tough guy.
Oh, he should have had, like, the blanket thing over him, like Eastwood. Like, he's got the right hat. He's got the cigar. Yeah.
And Richard Benjamin looks more like, you know, an accountant.
Right.
You know, and I'm not trying to insult accountants or whatever, but, you know, it's just that's what they're trying to give you off.
Right. It's all very deliberate, signaling.
Yeah. And so the Yul Brynner robot turns to Richard Benjamin and is like, all right, now it's you and me again. And guess what? It ain't going to go like the other two times. And Richard Benjamin very smartly is like, doesn't try to get his gun out. He just takes off running.
Yeah, he just, exactly.
And we're also, again, we'll keep cutting back to the technicians trying to shut this all down and monitor everything, and we're seeing in Roman world and medieval world the robots are just killing everybody. You know, it's wholesale slaughter. And then it's announced like that one of the guys like, and we've lost power in the room, you know, the technicians are like, and down in this airtight bunker, they've lost power in the room, and it's like, we can't get these doors open, we're gonna suffocate. And again, it's like,
Why? Like why is it? Yeah.
You know, if you don't have some sort of safety where you can force those doors open if the power goes out.
Yeah. So much hubris in this endeavor. Yeah.
And even if you don't have a safety override to open those doors without power, you don't have airflow as any type of vent to offer, you know, so you don't suffocate. And that's what ends up happening to that entire room of technicians. They all suffocate and die in that room.
They don't get torn apart by vengeful murder bots. They just suffocate.
So most of the rest of the movie is Yul Brynner in relentless pursuit of Richard Benjamin.
And it's fantastic.
And he is, again, he's just terrifying. And sometimes even when you don't see him, because you can constantly hear him with his spurs clanking. So when you don't see him, you still hear him stepping. And he holds this robotic pose. You know, he's got this classic, you know, thumbs around his belt type of, you know, gunslinger stance that he holds. Very robotic. It is an excellent, excellent performance by an excellent actor, Yul Brynner.
He is outstanding in this, because, yes, he's acting just robotic enough, but not cartoonishly so.
And menacing.
And perfectly, yes, perfectly. He's got like that, yeah, he's got that little bit of a glint in his eye. Well, he's got those metal eyes, right? And he's got that kind of, you know, almost like a smirk on him as he's doing that, just slightly bow-legged, just mechanical enough, but also just realistic enough that you're not sure. But then, yes, when you hear him, and I don't know, it really, really worked for me when Richard Benjamin's later in the tunnels in like the underground offices or whatever, and he's just hearing the click of Yul Brynner somewhere behind him, clicking his way through the hallways.
Yes. Yes,
I love that part. I absolutely love that whole sequence.
And all the while, you know, as Richard Benjamin, he jumps on a horse to gallop out, and, you know, Brynner jumps on a horse to chase after him. And you see, like, they give you the robot's eye view that he's using all these upgrades they gave him to his visual cortex and his hearing to track Richard Benjamin down so that Richard Benjamin can't get away. Because as Richard Benjamin's escaping, he comes on a technician in a cart who's trying to repair the cart and get out of there. And he's like, oh, at first he's afraid of Richard Benjamin. He's like, oh, you're human too.
Yeah.
Something's gone wrong. You know, the robots are killing everybody. It's like, Richard Benjamin's like, yeah, I know. There's a robot tracking me. And he's like, oh, is it one of, yeah, is it one of these things? Like, I don't know. Well, you don't have a chance, because
you're screwed.
It's done. It's going to get you.
I love this guy. Yeah. I kind of love this guy. I forgot his name. I'll see if I could look it up. But I do love his part, because, like, he is, if nothing else, he's no nonsense.
And if you didn't, again, if you somehow didn't understand just how dangerous this robot was, he gets it across. Like, he explains, he's got this enhanced vision. He'll be able to track you. He's got this enhanced hearing. He's going to hear you wherever you are.
Yes. He methodically explains all the ways that Richard Benjamin is definitely screwed. And I'm paraphrasing, but he's basically just like, you know, just kiss your ass goodbye. You're screwed. You're done. You're done. You're done. You're done. You're done.
Which makes me wonder, too, did this inspire James Cameron when he was writing Michael Biehn's speech in The Terminator about how, you know, he describes the Terminator and how it's remorseless and it will find her and kill her. It's what he does.
Well, the same, that and sort of like the computer eye, because that's apparently CGI in 1973.
Yeah.
That the, like the computer resolution effects where, you know, it shows up as rectangles, I guess, because of the aspect ratio. And you know, yeah. I wasn't sure if that was some sort of like painted effect or whatever, like they did with, Escape or parts of Escape from New York, but no, I guess that was actually done with computer graphics. And it's I wonder, yeah, if that, you know, how much of this inspired Terminator.
Yeah. So as Richard Benjamin rides on, because he realized this technician isn't going to help him, well, the technician is gunned down by Yul Brynner, who's not far behind, and Benjamin is able to make his way to what looks like Roman. It's either Roman or medieval world, but I think it's Roman world.
And it's Roman world.
Whatever happened there is either because the technicians also mentioned that all these robots are going to run out of their power cells within, you know, 12 hours. And when he gets to Roman world, it seems like either everybody's dead and all the robots are run out of power, or at least anybody who's not dead is hiding.
Right. It's hard to tell because there's not like a ton of blood or anything. So it's like, are these bodies or robots or
what? Robots that have, you know, collapsed. Yeah. And he finds his way into the underground, you know, the command complex, and he's running around these tunnels. And sure enough, the robot Brynner is able to track him down and follow him in there. And yeah, that's where it gets, you know, the noise starts getting scary, because as he's wandering these hallways, he can hear, like you said, Brenner's,
click,
you know,
click, click, click. It works every bit as well as the motion sensor in Aliens. And maybe even more so, because he's not armed.
Yeah, and at some point, he even hears, like, Brenner's running now.
Yeah, when he starts running. Yeah, I love that scene.
It's even scarier.
That whole sequence is fantastic. Like, that it might be that scene the most that makes the movie for me, but, you know, I like this a lot. I like this movie a lot.
Yeah. So Benjamin finds his way to the repair lab. He finds, you know, all the robots laid out on these stretchers, and he gets to a table with tools and chemicals and whatever. Apparently, they use acid to...
Well, one of the things the technician mentioned was, like, you could throw acid in his face and disrupt his, you know, cortex.
His visual,
Use fire to disrupt... Yeah, like, he kind of lists off what he'll actually use later. But I do have a problem with this scene. Again, it's a nitpick in an otherwise fun movie. But how he manages to trick Brenner here, I don't really understand.
Well, Brenner is probably still following the kind of the footprints.
Yeah, but you don't think he notices the big glowing, like, heat signature on the cot?
You know, but I don't know. Maybe he was underestimating Richard Benjamin, because, yeah, Richard Benjamin lies down on one of the stretchers to pretend to be one of the broken robots, but he doesn't fool Brenner for long.
No.
You know, it only fools him long enough for him to be able to throw the acid in Brenner's face and, you know, run away. And Brenner continues tracking him, but now, like you said, the visual, like, it obviously did something to disrupt the cameras, because now he's tracking Benjamin much like the Predator with a heat signature. So Benjamin keeps on running. He comes across, you know, the main control room where the guy's obviously suffocated inside. And then he comes up in what's medieval world. And again, everybody's either dead or the robots are shut down and non-moving. It seems like he and Brenner are the last two things alive. And, you know, Brenner's tracking him, but there's all these torches, these big fiery torches all over the castle room that he's in. And that's when he realizes that Brenner can't distinguish him if he gets close enough to a heat source. So he realizes, if I stand underneath this huge flaming cauldron, he can't pick me up with his infrared. And there's a very tense scene where Benjamin is standing there, and the robot's just, like, just a few feet away and kind of, like, looking, like, almost again, like the T-Rex, waiting for movement in Jurassic Park.
Right.
It's like he's right there, almost like...
It's similar to that scene, too, where he's, like, staying between the eyes or whatever, like, yes, trying to stay out of the periphery. Yeah. Or into.
And, you know, Brenner's looking around and looking, and Benjamin's just trying to be as still as possible and not make any noise. And when the robot turns away, he's just about to run, but he trips over something and alerts him, and the chase is on again. Finally, he's able to get a torch, because he escapes Brenner and he thinks he's come across another human.
Yes.
Who's chained up in the dungeon. And he's helping her, and he's like, "Yeah, let me give you some water." And he's like, "No, no, no water, no water." And of course, he gives her water, and that short circuits her.
It's a pretty gnarly scene.
Yeah.
I mean, it's there just for that effect, I guess. They had the money to do that effect, and they did it.
Then Brenner comes running into the room, and Benjamin grabs a torch and sets him on fire. And then we get this again. We've talked about full body burns that stuntmen do and how dangerous they are. We get a spectacular full body burn destroying this robot.
For quite a while, too.
Yes. I mean, and you almost wonder, it's like, did they program these things to feel pain? Because the way it's flailing around, it seems like it's reacting to being on fire.
For sure. Yeah, right. The effect that they use too, and the models that they use when you know Brenner's face comes off, and you just see, like, the robotics behind it, it's really well done.
Yeah.
The effects for this movie, you know, there's not a whole ton of them, because it's mostly humans posing as robots, right? But when they peel back the skin, as it were, I don't know. I think it works pretty well, and the way that the electronics kind of burn is very authentic as well. I like the way that they kind of like fizzle out, like the way that the girl that he thought was a robot after he'd given her some water, like it's not overly dramatic. It's just like, it looks like some capacitors explode or something, and it's just this jet of steam come flying out of her neck. I think it's a nice touch.
Yeah, it's very interestingly done. So, setting fire to the Brenner robot works, and Benjamin kind of collapses down on the steps, and the movie comes to an end. There's no, any more dramatic jump scares or anything like that. And that's it. But it's, I guess you really didn't need any more. I suppose they could have shown, maybe rescue coming or whatever, but the adventure's over. You might as well end it there.
Have you read the book? Or do you know much about the book?
Didn't know there was a book.
Oh, I assumed there was a book.
No, I don't think this was based on a book. I think it was written and created. There might have been a novelization.
Oh, right on. I assumed there was a book because I wasn't sure if there was anything at any point that clarifies once and for all. Not that I need it necessarily, but I'm just curious if there's something that clarifies for sure, like, is this a conscious revolution on the part of the robots, or is this a symptom of some sort of generic malfunction because they weren't really paying attention to what they were doing? Because at one point they allude to as much when they when one of the scientists says something along, or engineers says something along the lines of like, oh, they're designing themselves at this point, and we don't even really
Yes.
understand how they're doing it. Which
Yes.
you could take to read as, a Skynet type consciousness is building and the robots are getting annoyed and fighting off. And I think that seems to be what's implied here. Or is it a, they're kind of stuck in a failure loop and they're programmed to be aggressive, but those fail safes have failed and now they think they're doing what they're programmed to do, to the best of their ability.
Well, for answers, you would have to wait. I mean, the movie itself doesn't provide those answers, but Future World does.
Oh, it does. Okay, because I've never seen Future World.
Future World, which is the sequel, takes place several years later. The Delos is reopening the park, only now it's Future World, Medieval World, and Roman World. Westworld is not being reopened
What?
because, as they say, Westworld got all the real bad publicity about what happened. Whatever. For whatever reasons, the reports seem to specify, and maybe it's because Richard Benjamin was the only survivor and he could really only discuss his experiences in Westworld. Westworld is shut down because they didn't think anybody would revisit it.
Wouldn't the fact that he was the only survivor imply that Westworld was the more survivable one?
Well, but again,
But
it
it
might
just
have just
seems
been.
like that's unfortunate.
And maybe even Delos spun it to make it seem like, oh, the problem was all in Westworld. It wasn't anywhere else. So we're shutting that part
I
down.
mean, you know they would bring it back in like 5 years. And would you go? Would you go to like the reopening of Delos's, or would you wait like for a couple of months at least? Like, would you be right there
Well,
if you could? Or...
it seems like the earlier you go, the better off you are.
Probably.
So, anyways, in Future World, it's revealed that Delos, or the executors of Delos, were quietly building robot replicas of world leaders and powerful businessmen. And eventually, they were going to, anytime a rich businessman, industrialist, or a world leader would visit the park, they would be murdered and replaced with a robot so that eventually Delos could control the world. And apparently,
Ew.
the programming was put in there, and it's kind of almost blamed on the Yul Brynner for being the first one upgraded. It jumped the gun on its murderousness, and that infected like the other robots, and that's what the rebellion came too early.
So, like, the Yul Brynner bot was taken over by the consciousness of some angry politician or something?
No. It was program. The robots were basically programmed
For murder.
for murder, but only a specific people, so that Delos could replace them with robots. And that way, you know, like, oh, if the CEO of, you know, an important oil company is now a robot being controlled by Delos. Well, now Delos controls that oil company.
Okay, if, all right.
If the president of the United States comes and visits Delos and he's replaced by a robot duplicate, well, now Delos is controlling the president of the United States.
It's a little too James Bond for me, but all right.
So, yeah, and in the movie, the reporters stumble upon the secret, and of course there's, you know, espionage and intrigue and murder, and they have to get out with the secret to warn the world. And
have you seen it?
Yes.
Is it any good?
It is. It's different. It's more paranoid thriller than Westworld, which is, you know, kind of more disaster. This is more conspiracy thriller.
Okay.
So that's what helps it work too, is that it's almost a separate movie, you know, than Westworld.
Got it. Okay.
And I guess that's what Beyond Westworld was about as well, is the Delos conspiracy. And only in Beyond Westworld, it's like it was a rogue scientist that was trying to do it, and he escapes with some of the robots, and an agent of Delos's security team is tracking him down. And that's what each episode would have been about, him trying to stop him from taking, you know, murdering an important person and replacing him with a robot.
Okay, I wonder if that's what the more recent one, if that's the direction.
From what I understand about the more recent one, this was more about the point of view of the robots and what makes somebody human and sentient.
Oh, got it. Okay, so it's more of a, you got, yeah, all right. It's more of what it seems that this movie was implying.
Yes.
Or at least you could make the argument anyway. Got it. Okay.
Yeah, but with this is an exciting and fun and quick little film to enjoy.
Yeah, no, this is,
especially if you like old school science fiction adventure.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. This is a good Saturday. This is a good Saturday afternoon one.
And everybody gives a great performance, and the effects are all in. Again, we nitpicked all these stupid little things, sure, you know, but it is what it is.
I mean, well, it's a sci-fi, you know, exactly. It is what it is. There you go.
Got anything else to say specifically about this movie?
No, except for it's going to be one that I think I'm going to certainly watch more often.
All right. Recommendations?
Well, recommendations would probably be almost anything else that Michael Crichton has done. Certainly ones we've covered, like if you haven't checked out 13th Warrior or Runaway. Like Runaway, I think, is still my favorite of his. I just love that movie.
And it's a great movie about robots malfunctioning and attacking, you know, people that it's not in their programming to attack. In fact, you could almost see Runaway as Crichton's sequel to Westworld.
Yeah. Yeah, in a way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I can recommend Predator.
Yep.
Terminator.
Yep.
Jurassic Park. All these elements, you know, from this movie you would see used later. It's just really fun stuff. You know, I'm going to also recommend a little bit out there. Maybe people have heard of it. It's a movie called GOG, G-O-G. And it's about robots in a secret underground government lab being reprogrammed by a spy to murder the scientists and staff of this lab. It's a Cold War conspiracy thriller. Not nearly as exciting as this movie, but a different take on almost the same material about how these robots that are built to assist these scientists and run the facility being reprogrammed to kill them and, you know, get secrets revealed.
That does sound familiar.
Anything else?
No, I mean, not about this. Like I said, I forgot. And when you had recommended Westworld, I was like, oh yeah, great. Cause it's, you know, I finally have a chance to see it. Cause Westworld has been a movie that it's not hard to find at all, and it's one that pops up, and I'll be like, you know what? At someday I'll get around to watching that again someday. And I ended up being probably two and a half decades or so. It's definitely going to be one that I put in heavier rotation, or at least we'll try to, because I think it absolutely deserves it. I had forgotten it was a Michael Crichton movie in until it got closer to it, and then I remembered, because I thought, you know, I started thinking about how close it was to Jurassic Park, and then it finally dawned on me that, oh yeah, it's the same same writer.
Yeah, no, it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Which made me remember, like, wow, we've already done a couple of Michael Crichton movies, and, you know, here are some other ones. Like, I really like his stuff. I think he's an underrated director.
All right. So, I mean, obviously, the Magnificent Seven connection is right out there with Yul Brynner. He's even dressed in the same outfit as he wears in the Magnificent Seven. But that's a little too convenient. Todd, what's another way to go?
So James Brolin was in High Risk with Ernest Borgnine, who was in Escape from New York with Lee Van Cleef, who was in A Posse from Hell with John Saxon, who was in Battle Beyond the Stars with Robert Vaughn.
Okay. You know who else was in High Risk with James Brolin?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, Richard Benjamin was in The Last of Sheila with James Coburn, who also happened to be in High Risk with James Brolin.
That's right.
All right. Well, with that, as always, we thank you for listening. You can follow us on X, Blue Sky, but really where you want to follow us is on Letterboxd, the app for movie fans. I'm constantly rating movies, ranking movies, and putting up lists. If you really want to follow up my opinion on movies, I'm trying to get Todd to set up an account so you can look at his stuff too. But I just, for instance, ranked all 25 official James Bond movies in order of my favorite to my least favorite. So you can follow us on there.
Trying to think if I've actually seen every Bond. Actually, I know for sure I haven't seen every Bond film. I know I haven't seen like the last two or three Daniel Craig ones, but I don't think I've seen everything before it as well. So it is. I assume you're not including like the made-for-TV Casino Royale.
No, that's nor did I include the Never Say Never Again.
Gotcha. Okay.
But you know. I suppose I could throw that up there too, just for the sake of argument. But yeah,
how about OK? How about Agent OK Connery or whatever it was with Sean Connery's brother?
Oh yeah, Operation 007.
Right, the Mystery Science Theater one too. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, as always, we thank you for listening and hope to have you back next time.
Thank you, everyone.
I forgot. We're on Twitter and Letterboxd and Blue Sky at Movie Matt Sirois, all one word, MOVIEMATTSIROIS. Stay gold, people.
Thank you, everyone.